Good afternoon. This is Bob Kruger with Thought for Food for October of 2020. This program is heard on the third Wednesday of the month at 4 p.m. and repeated on the third month at 3 p.m. It's intended for a blind and print-impaired audience, but hopefully will be of interest to everyone. Special days in October began with Columbus Day on the 12th. The United States Navy was established on October 13th in 1775. The 24th is United Nations Day, and we end the month with Halloween Day on the 31st. This year, because of the pandemic, parents, children, and candy manufacturers are all concerned about whether to allow trick-or-treating, as we usually do. The candy makers usually make 25% of their yearly sales in October. When I think of this issue, I don't know what to say, especially when I think of my great-grandchildren. My oldest great-grandchild, Aaron Wilson, will be 6 years old on the 1st. October is National Apple Month, as many varieties of apples ripen and are picked in October, although some varieties are already ready to pick earlier in the year. Apple cuttings came to this country in the baggage of immigrants. The Mohawk Valley of upstate New York is one of the first areas that produced fine fruit, but as settlers moved west, they took apples with them, all the way to the Pacific Northwest. Today, the state of Washington produces 25% of the national apple crop. In the early 1900s, the United States was war over pie. Yeah, the dessert. On one side was the traditionalists who saw pie as an article of necessity in every household, as much as the bed and the cook stove, according to a Chicago Daily Tribune report in 1899. On the other side were the food reformers who wanted to break this unhealthy and corrupting habit. Pie really is an American evil, Kate Masterson wrote in the New York Times in 1902. It's an unmoral food, she warned, offering advice for spotting pie eaters. They have sallow complexions and lustreless or unnatural bright eyes, and of course, they're all dyspeptic. No great man, she wrote, was ever fond of pie. Those were fighting words. Pie eaters, and count me as one, trace their love of the dish back to the founding fathers. A particular pumpkin pie recipe credited to the Adams family was said by the Kansas City Star to have raised a well-fed race of jurists, scholars, orators, and presidents. The pie tradition of the New England colonies had come from Old England with the settlers, who changed the savory kidney and mincemeat pies of the British Isles into sweet pies filled with fruits that grew well along the Atlantic coast. The crust changed, too. They became lighter and flakier because lard from pigs was more abundant in the colonies than tallow from cattle. In 1982, Rudyard Kipling described the Northeast as the Great American Pie Belt, a title that traditionalists claimed proudly. As the population moved west, the pie recipes did too. By the turn of the century, that's 1900, Americans were eating more apple pie than any other variety. Apples first brought to the continent by the colonists grew across wide areas of the country and could be stored through the winter, unlike most other fresh fruits. The phrase, as American as apple pie, could not be coined until a 1924 advertisement in the Gettysburg, Pennsylvania Times for men's suits that bucked English fashion traditions. But the idea was already so deeply ingrained that pie eating became a way for the country's newest arrivals, now mainly from Central, Southern, and Eastern Europe, to assimilate. Every American is born with an appetite for pie, a New York newspaper said in 1895. As for the immigrant, the paper wrote, his Americanism is, in fact, may be tested in his taste for pie. To the growing food reform movement, though, pie was a remnant of our rusty past before the United States had taken its place on the international stage. Advocates such as Harvey Wiley, now best known for his support of the Pure Food and Drug Act of 1906, called for a simpler and lighter diet, focusing on Northern European cuisines. Pie eaters, code for immigrants of lower classes in the language of the food reformers, was a drag on society. Elizabeth Fulton, a home economist at Kansas State Normal School, believed that pie eating, like alcoholism, was a cause for divorce. She implored homemakers to return to fresh fruit. The reporters might have won the battle if not for World War I. Now pie eating was patriotic. As soon as an American boy goes to stay in a foreign country, he once begins to languish for American pie, a Boston Daily Globe editorial professed in 1918. The craving, the Globe wrote, was a hunger for democracy itself. Patrick Henry might as well have said, "Give me pie or give me death," because what is liberty without pie? It maintained its symbolic significance into the Cold War. When Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev visited New York City in the fall of 1960 to address the United Nations, a woman named Virginia McCleary sent a package from her Texas home to Khrushchev's residence on Park Avenue. The bomb squad was called to examine the 5-pound delivery. Inside was an apple pie. The pastry, McCleary said, would introduce Khrushchev to American values. The communist pie is nothing but crust, but in America we have an upper crust and a lower crust, but it's what's in between, the middle class, that gives the real flavor. Today, apple pie tastes like nostalgia, as in the unforgettable, try as one might, 1974 General Motors jingle. Baseball, hot dogs, apple pie, and Chevrolet, they go together in the good old USA. The company revived it in 2013 as the nation emerged from the financial crisis of 9/11. Despite the current ad for locally grown fresh foods that are low-carb, keto-friendly, and glucose-free, we still have a soft spot for this classic dessert. About 186 million pies of all kinds are purchased every year in the nation's grocery stores alone. The ingredients have evolved over the years and stepped with the waves of the immigrants. Think mango, Asian pears, and banana split. But America's undisputed favorite is an apple pie. While these remarks are about pie, how does one make a pie without apples to fill it? Many folks recommend Granny Smith apples to make that apple pie. The late Julia Childs, who popularized French cuisine to Americans, enjoyed a slice of Granny Smith apple with a smear of peanut butter on it. Now for a bit of apple history. In 1884, the apple that will dominate and disappoint 20th century taste arises accidentally on Jesse Hyatt's farm in Peru, Iowa. He called the elongated red and yellow striped food the Hawkeye. In 1893, the Hawkeye wins the competition run by Stark Brothers Nursery of Missouri to replace the pretty but not very tasty Ben Davis apple. "My, this apple's delicious," said the president of the nursery, which buys the right to the apple. He names it Delicious. In 1904, Stark Brothers exhibited the Delicious at the Louisiana Purchase Exposition in St. Louis. It's part of a $750,000 marketing campaign that includes giving away 8 million trees by 1819. It won't become the Red Delicious till Stark produces the Golden Delicious in 1914. In 1923, a limb of a Red Delicious tree in New Jersey produces apples with a deeper crimson color. Stark Brothers purchases a limb for $6,000 to cultivate the redder fruit. When consumers perceive as perfectly ripe, we ask, how can they do this? With fruit trees, grafting a limb or a twig into an existing stump or tree trunk is a method used to produce the result you want. Experts of that day said, this one limb will make horticultural history. In 1942, the first USDA data on apple production showed that Red Delicious, with 21.4 million bushels harvested, is almost twice as popular as its nearest competitor, the Macintosh. It will remain number one for more than 75 years. In 1950, growers began to cater to supermarkets, producing beautiful, uniform fruit with a long shelf life. With a taste as an afterthought, the Red Delicious soon became a staple in school lunches and garbage cans. In 1974, Stark Brothers received the first patent for the Gale apple across a Red Delicious, Gold Delicious, and Cox's Orange Pippin, first cultivated in New Zealand in 1934. It had something that Red Delicious no longer had, flavor. In 2000, decreased demand for the durable but bland Red Delicious, better for table decorations than it is for eating, noted one food expert, caused a crisis in the American apple industry. President Bill Clinton signs a $138 million bailout for apple growers. In 2018, Gala surpasses Red Delicious as the most grown apple in the U.S. The Honeycrisp is gaining, but Red Delicious still bulks large, accounting for half of U.S. apple exports. It's beloved in China and India, where the color red is auspicious. New varieties of apples seem to come on the market almost every day. Among them are the Pink Lady and the Snapdragon, a new variety developed by Cornell University. As new varieties come to the market, older ones seem to disappear. Gravenstein's, Magnabonum, and early transparent apples are among those no longer produced. There are a few orchardists who strive to find and reproduce these no longer popular varieties. Apples make great snacks, whenever possible, eat with the skins on, as the food value of an apple is just below the skin, near the outside of the fruit. When we peel the apple, most of the food value is gone. From time to time, I've shared with you a column written by B. Wilson with the title Table Talk. This time, she says, it's time to revive the interesting breakfast. As we read this article, think of what you had for breakfast. I know that I'm in a rut, pretty much the same thing every day. There's much debate about breakfast. Do we eat early in the day, eat later in the morning, or maybe not eat until noon? Health experts can't agree, so my idea is to have breakfast when you want to. Back to Mrs. Wilson's story. Why has breakfast become the least interesting meal of the day, at least in the West? It wasn't always so. As I was reminded when reading A Taste of Country Cooking by the late, great Edna Lewis, first published in 1976. Lewis was born in 1916 and grew up on a farm in Freetown, Virginia. The American breakfast she describes were stupendous feasts on a par with Thanksgiving dinners. Lewis and her family would routinely start the day with heavy dishes such as fried chicken with brown gravy, ham and heavy cream sauce, fried corn, green corn, or pan-fried sweet potatoes. She describes breakfast as about the best part of the day when everyone greeted each other with a real sense of gratefulness to see the new day. In theory, breakfast should be the meal every bit as tasty and excited as any other. So it's sad that in the hustle of modern life, it so often ends up being some form of dull processed starch, an interesting bowl of breakfast cereal or a slice of toast. About the only people who still make a cooked breakfast seem to be the low-carb brigade, but there's a tendency for the meal to be something utilitarian, such as a protein pot of hard-boiled eggs and spinach. This kind of breakfast is more like swallowing a vitamin pill than giving yourself something to savor. Compare and contrast with Lewis's example of a full breakfast, which starts with a hearty dish of oatmeal and cream. Next comes smothered rabbit, pieces of rabbit fried and then braised with bacon and shallot, served with fried tomatoes, corn muffins, freshly made biscuits, wild blackberry jelly, and butter. To drink, there's cocoa for children and plenty of delicious hot coffee for grown-ups. Such an elaborate breakfast is a world away from the morning food of modern America. You'd be astonished, and perhaps in not a good way, to see smothered rabbit for sale at Starbucks, along with muffins and croissants. More to the point, we don't seem to have expected our breakfast should be as flavorsome or as varied as our lunches or dinners. Given that we typically eat 365 breakfasts a year, this is a wasted opportunity. Part of why breakfast got downgraded is that people are driven by modern patterns of work to eat too early when the appetite isn't very strong. The hearty breakfast of Edna Lewis was eaten after the morning feed of animals in the farm. Cows had to be milked, I remember that. Every bite of biscuit and sip of coffee was a sweet reward for the work already done. By contrast, office workers now eat breakfast before any of the day's work has been attempted, in a panicky and slightly nauseous state. No wonder we fall back on the comfort of morning ritual. For years, when my children were small, and it felt like a crazed rush to get them to to school on time, I ate exactly the same breakfast every day like clockwork, coffee and toast with butter and marmalade. It wasn't thrilling, but it was one less thing to think about. For some people working at home during the pandemic, it's been easier to have later and more leisurely breakfast. This changes the kind of things you may feel like eating. When breakfast is prepared first thing in a sleepy-eyed and under-caffeinated state, you may struggle to embark on anything more challenging than a toasted bagel or a bowl of yogurt. But when you already have coffee in your body and a Zoom meeting under your belt, you may branch out and turn your mind to more brunch-like dishes such as a spicy shakshuka of eggs poached in a rich cumin-scented tomato sauce and topped with cilantro. Boring breakfasts are a failure of imagination as much as anything. We have a tendency, encouraged by the multinational breakfast cereal industry, to think of breakfast food as composing a very narrow set of ingredients centered on wheat flour and sugar. But there's still places in the world with a more flavorsome breakfast repertoire. Before the pandemic, the best breakfasts I ate were always when traveling. I remember breakfast of spinach pie and watermelon in Greece, of giant crispy dosas and curry in India, of dumplings and savory congee in China. Now that extensive traveling is off the table, I'm trying to eat more exciting breakfast at home, at least a couple of days a week. Sometimes, instead of spreading my toast with butter, I rub it with garlic, anoint it with tomato pulp, oil and salt, and pretend I'm in Spain. When you eat a different breakfast, the whole day starts off on a fresh note, and God knows we need that now. I've enjoyed experimenting with breakfast in a superb new science-based cookbook, The Flavor Equation, by Nick Sharma. The recipes include Mr. Sharma's mother's favorite breakfast of vegetable pakoras, delighted fritters made from kale and ginger, which he grew up eating in India for weekend breakfast. His big idea is that even a simple meal cooked in a home kitchen can be special when we pay more attention to flavor and texture. I don't know anyone who hasn't been forced to shelve plans this year. Trying to eat better breakfast is the kind of ambition that's within reach. When it seems you have nothing to celebrate, you can still celebrate the fact you've made it through another night, and there are delicious new things to be eaten. Thank you, Mrs. Wilson. It appears to me that one element in preparing a more interesting breakfast is, how much time do I have to do the job properly? The world's most popular beverages are becoming more expensive. Remote working arrangements and other house routines established in the pandemic have led to more people to reach for cups of tea, which is consumed in larger amounts worldwide than they drink other than water. But supplies of tea leaves are tightening due to bad weather in some producing countries, labor shortages, port closures, and other logistical issues. Prices of wholesale tea leaves have jumped 50% since March, when they tumbled to the lowest levels in more than a decade due to oversupply. At $1.44 a pound recently, they are at levels last seen in November of 2012, according to the World Bank data. Some of the increase has started to lift store prices in the U.S. Prices of so-called liquid tea, which is typically sold as bottled concentrate, have on average increased 9.6% from a year earlier, while prices for packaged tea sold in tea bags have risen 1.7%, according to Nielsen, a market research firm. Prices of ready-to-drink tea, which comes already prepared in bottles, cans, or packets, have been stable. This is largely a supply-driven event, says El Manouk Arump, economist in the Raw Materials and Tropical Products team at the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations. The FAO previously warned that the climate change is threatening the limited agroecology areas required for tea production, while global consumption is growing as more people believe in the antioxidant properties and other health benefits of tea. Around the world, about 3.7 billion cups of tea are consumed daily, according to Tea USA, an industry association. The majority of American tea drinkers consume the black variety, and most prefer it iced. The beverage is especially popular among the millennials, according to Tea USA. The pandemic has caused sharp drops in tea consumption at restaurants and cafes, but more people are spending more time at home or brewing and drinking more tea, according to industry players. Tea is often grown on terraced hillsides in mountainous regions with tropical or subtropical climates. China, India, Kenya, and Sri Lanka dominate the world's tea production, while most tea sold in the United States is grown in Argentina, according to data from the FAO and the United Nations Comtrade database. Sri Lanka and India, leaves are largely picked by hand from evergreen shrubs before they're dried and packaged for sale. Workers focus on picking small, young leaves that taste better than older, more coarse ones. Tea leaves typically take about 2 weeks to grow before they're ready for picking. The color is determined by the way they're processed. Earlier this year, a severe drought in Sri Lanka, the world's third largest tea exporter, resulted in production falling by 15% in the first 7 months of 2020 from a year earlier. Exports have dropped to 10%, according to the country's Tea Exporters Association. In neighboring India, tea production has also fallen. The country has been hard hit by the pandemic, and social distancing rules have, in some cases, prevented workers from getting to the fields for harvesting. Trucking services in the country have been disrupted, and port closures have led to export and shipping delays. In August, tea prices at an auction hit a record high. The shortage has been compromised by severe flooding in Assam in northeastern India, which produces the bulk of the country's tea, according to data provider Mintec. Some industry analysts say tea prices should stop climbing as production improves in Sri Lanka and Kenya. Earlier, an oversupply forced some companies to sell bulk tea leaves at less than what it cost to produce the commodity, said Joshua Kaiser, founder of Rishi Tea and Botanicals, a firm that purchases directly from growers. "We're now seeing the real cost of production flowing through the market," he said. "How much this will affect local tea drinkers, we can only guess." The U.S. corn supply, already projected to reach near record levels, is continuing to grow thanks to supportive weather in the Midwest that has improved crop yields. In its monthly supply and demand report released in early August, the USDA said it expected 2020 corn production to total 15.3 billion, that's with a B, up 278 million bushels from its previous estimate. The big factor in the increase in higher yields per crop acre, where USDA now predicts to be a record 181.8 bushels per acre. Adequate rainfall and consistent temperatures have allowed farmers to raise a healthy crop. In a slightly weekly crop report, the USDA says 71% of the corn's crop is in either good or excellent condition. That's up from 57% this time last year. However, this USDA report didn't account for the hurricane-force winds that battered the Midwest in early August. That storm may have damaged as much as 300 million bushels of U.S. corn, according to University of Illinois' Agricultural Marketing Department. The final figure is that there'll be an increase of about 500 million bushels of corn over what was produced last year. Corn is the ingredient in many of the cold cereals we eat in this country. During confinement of this pandemic, have you ever ordered pizza? You can pick it up after ordering it by phone or having it delivered. Many of us have done just that. Planning and preparing meals often seems an almost impossible job, so we opt for a pizza that someone else prepares. The result has been a robust sale last quarter report for Domino's Pizza. In July, Domino's reported that their sales in the previous quarter in stores in the U.S. had been open at least a year. Sales rose 16%. The second quarter marked a rather unprecedented acceleration for food delivery in the U.S., and was certainly no exception, said Chief Executive Rich Allison. Many restaurant companies have said their sales slumped after authorities closed dining rooms earlier in the year because of the coronavirus pandemic. That pushed chains to bolster their delivery options, creating new competition for Domino's, long known for delivering food. The company has worked to develop new ways to interact with consumers during the pandemic. Under its contactless delivery method, workers place pizza atop a box outside of a customer's home, notify them, and move it 6 feet away. They now add a new feature for pickup orders that allows drive up customers to describe their vehicle and indicate where they want the food placed by the restaurant worker. Domino's expects safety and contactless interaction to remain a priority for diners in the foreseeable future. And I imagine this is the method many of Domino's competitors are using. Here are some ideas from Nutrition Action, a publication for the Centers for Science in the Public Interest. A healthy lifestyle may prevent gallstones. Scientists followed roughly 100,000 people for up to 26 years. Women with the healthiest lifestyles had a 74% and men had 83% lower risk of gallstones than those who had the least healthy lifestyles. Lifestyles factors linked to a lower risk were a healthier weight, which had the biggest impact, coffee at least 16 ounces a day, moderate alcohol intake, exercise, never smoking, and a high score on the alternative healthy eating index. The index adds points for eating vegetables, fruits, whole grains, nuts, beans, oils, and seafood, and subtracts points for sugary drinks, juice, salt, and red or processed meats. What to do? Aim for a healthy lifestyle. Although this study can't prove cause and effect, a similar lifestyle score has been linked to living longer without cancer, heart disease, and type 2 diabetes. For many of us, we senior citizens, getting up and walking around our homes is good for us. We who have some difficulty in mobility are tempted to sit. Not a good idea. Each of us needs an exercise program suitable for our solution. I try to do at least 20 minutes a day in my treadmill, set level and at the slowest speed. I can't move any faster. During the rest of the day, I need to take short walking breaks, doing at least 100 steps, either inside or outside. Can a healthy diet slow arthritis? A healthy diet may slow the progress of knee arthritis. Research followed 2,757 people with mild to moderate osteoarthritis in at least one knee. After an average of 4 years, those who reported eating a prudent dietary pattern, that is, a diet rich in fruits, vegetables, fish, whole grains, and beans, had a lower risk of worsening arthritis as measured by x-rays and by reported pain, stiffness, and disability scores. But researchers took other factors into account. It's still possible that something else explains why arthritis progresses less in healthy eaters. What to do? Aim for a healthy diet. Even if it doesn't slow your arthritis, you can slow your risk of heart disease, stroke, type 2 diabetes, and some cancers. The question is asked, what is a normal serving? Do large servings of food skew your sense of what is normal? Dutch researchers served 132 women, either a small portion of lasagna, about 280 calories, a large portion with 875 calories for lunch. The next day, the participants were told to eat as much as they wanted. And we've run out of time for today's episode of Thought for Food. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Bob Kruger, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. If you have any comment or question, please call us at 919-832-5138.